I'm Hillary McClure, Multimedia Director at Cybercrime Magazine. I'm here today with Joe Grand, a hardware hacker also known as Kingpin, who was a member of Loft Heavy Industries, a hacker collective based in the Boston area that was active between 1992 and 2000. To learn more about Joe, you can follow him on Twitter at Joe Grand. Joe, welcome. Thank you so much for coming onto the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So Joe, I know a little bit about your background, as I just shared when I introduced you, but I'd love to hear more from you about what prompted you to have an interest in technology. What were some of the first devices and hardware that you used as a kid? Because it's my understanding you got into hardware and technology and hacking pretty young.
Yeah, so I got involved in computers and electronics in 1982. When I was 7 years old. Back then, technology wasn't as pervasive as it was now. So the people that really gravitated towards technology were just really curious people, hackers, engineers. And I was just lucky that my brother is 6 years older than me, and my parents had bought him an Atari 400 computer, and my sister also, who's older. And they both sort of got bored with the computer right around the time where I was getting old enough to be independent and use the computer and know how to, you know, play games on it and stuff like that. I just loved everything about the computer. I can't even, still to this day, I have an Atari 400 in my office. And there's just something about being able to have the computer do things like to play games, but then have it also do what you want it to do and what you tell it to do. I basically just started very young collecting video games and connecting to bulletin board systems using a modem. At the time, we had a 300 baud acoustic coupler modem, so you had to use like the rotary phone and then put the earpiece and the microphone into this device that had suction cups, basically, and then you'd have audio over the telephone lines to another computer system. So very primitive, but I would connect to local bulletin board systems and trade games with other people. But then there was sort of this desire of like, all right, the local bulletin board systems, I've already gotten everything I wanted out of those. I want to branch out to other computer systems and meet other people and get different games that aren't available on these systems. Making phone calls was really expensive, and I was really young. And sometimes I did call normal phone numbers and have to pay for it. So I think I was like maybe by that point 9 or 10 years old. And I remember I grew up in Boston, Massachusetts, and I called a bulletin board system in New York, upstate New York. And the bill was probably like $50 or $100. And that's really where I learned, like, okay, this is not sustainable. And my parents, you know, made me pay it off little by little. So I ended up, and actually with the help of my brother, figuring out how to make free phone calls. And at the time, that was using commercial systems for business people to make phone calls. And you could call an 800 number, toll-free number, and then enter in usually a six-digit code that would be billed to the corporation, and then you could make your long-distance call. So I started doing that and then connecting to bulletin board systems further away. And at the same time, instead of just focusing on software, realizing like, oh, you can trade other information like other codes to get free phone calls or passwords to other computer systems that weren't bulletin board systems, but things connected to the phone lines, kind of like the internet is now, right? Everything's connected. And if you go, say you go to Shodan and you see all of the internet connected devices that are out there, a lot of them are insecure. You can just connect to them and see what's going on. And you may not want to do that nowadays because of the laws, but it was very kind of curious, naive exploration and wanting to just collect games and collect information and have things that other people didn't have. And then I started doing war dialing, hacking my own codes, basically by running programs to cycle through various combinations to try to get the correct codes to do free phone calls. And it just kind of branched out from there. So that was really the beginning of just, you know, discovering technology and falling in love with technology and having powers that nobody else at school had and pretty much nobody else had in the country, right? There was, you know, handful of groups all over the place, but it was such an early time in computing and in hacking, in home computing, you know, when it was becoming more accessible to people. And I fell in love with it and just never looked back.
Did your peers at school understand kind of the power that you had? And did they take you up on any of that?
No, not at all. Not at all. And it was something, you know, I mean, being into computers, being a nerd was not cool. You know, now it's cool because all of the nerds created all of the infrastructure that we're using these days. But it was not a cool thing. I mean, I at the time, I was also getting involved in skateboarding, which was also not cool at the time. So, you know, I'd be made fun of a lot. I wouldn't say I got beat up a lot, but I got tormented enough and, you know, I would fight back to the extent of my, you know, my capabilities, which were not much. And it was just, it was a hard time because it just wasn't accepted. Everything I was doing wasn't accepted. I was also getting involved. My brother, one of his friends introduced me to some like LA punk bands, you know, back in the mid 80s. So bands like Black Flag, Circle Jerks. And I just loved that. I felt it was weird because I was so young, but I knew that that was the route I was going. So even though at school I wasn't accepted, you know, I was kind of overweight. I was social enough. I had lots of friends and, you know, I knew a lot of them since kindergarten. And by this point, you know, fifth or sixth grade, everybody knew, oh, Joey is a computer nerd, right? Or a hacker. And that's what they would call me, Joey. And I went to a Halloween party in fifth grade once wearing all blue sweatpants, sweatshirt and bottoms, just because I thought that was cool. And I walked around with a 5 1/4 inch floppy disk. And people said, what are you? And I said, I'm a hacker. And like, to me, that was so cool. But they were just like, whatever. And, you know, in high school, we can get into that. But I ended up getting in trouble when I was 15, 16. And that kind of redirected things and made me have more of a balance. But at the time, at those early days, you know, literally it was like hours before school, I'd be on the computer doing stuff up on the third floor of my parents' house. They had this big old house in Boston. So I was up there in the computer room by myself. I'd go to school. Usually I'd start like some file transfers or something because they would take so long at 300 or 1200 bits a second that you'd be waiting, you know, a long time. So I would start the file transfer on a bulletin board system, go to school, come back, there'd be a new game. And for the rest of the afternoon, I would be there. And people didn't really know, even my parents, like there was a time they were having a party and I came downstairs with a printout of a credit rating of George Bush Sr. And when he was president. And because I had access to a credit bureau system, so I could look up people's names and get information. So I basically printed out the credit rating, which was most of it was like sanitized, or there wasn't a lot of information there, but it was very clear that I could at least see his record. And I brought it downstairs and, you know, they're basically like, oh, that's cool. You know, good job. But like nobody really knew what I was getting into from a mischievous perspective, but I think it was just, you know, that gravitation towards punk rock, my gravitation towards skateboarding and sort of just that side of things where society hadn't quite caught up to it. And then the hacking side, you know, I didn't really brag about what I was doing. I didn't really show off and I wasn't doing anything malicious, but I just loved having that capability. And if people were like, you know, making fun of me, it's like, yeah, but I could, you know, I could pull your parents' credit rating and steal their credit card and go, you know, buy stuff or take a limo ride or whatever it is. And it's just knowing that I had that power really was to me, that was the fun part.
So interesting that those things, skateboarding, computers, were like counterculture then, but they were. And so I guess, yeah, let's get into like the juvenile or like the adolescent times or like what you were getting into as you got older and you had this power. And I guess how much can we blame Henry Rollins or should he be listening? I'm sure he's not. But yeah, I'd love to know more about that and kind of what that set you up for as you kind of evolved.
Sure. Yeah, I definitely take full responsibility for everything. And I'm still, even at this age, I'm still, you know, I kind of look back at it and I'm still trying to work out like, why did I go that way, right? Most people that got involved in computers did not go down the path I did. Even today, most people that are hackers are generally on the good side. When I talk about hackers, I kind of clump everybody together because it's not just usually a black and white issue. But I say that, you know, there's a lot more good hackers than there are malicious hackers. And I still haven't figured out exactly why I ended up going down that path. If it wasn't computers, it would have been other stuff, right? I would have still been the mischievous, you know, wise ass punk kid. It just, that's the way I think I was just created. And you have, you know, the nature versus nurture discussion and all of that. And like, it is what it is, right? So I just loved all of these countercultural things. And to me, none of this stuff seemed abnormal. So to me, using the computer, skateboarding, going to punk and hardcore shows when I was, you know, 13 years old, that seemed normal. There was other people there that also gravitated towards these places. So it didn't seem normal to me. The stuff I was doing felt very faceless. And I sort of, you know, call myself a technological juvenile delinquent because most of the stuff I was doing, if I was going to connect to, say, an elevator control system or an environmental monitoring system or a cellular phone switch, You know, it mostly was just to explore and see what was out there. And, you know, I just loved technology. And I still, to this day, I love seeing behind the scenes of what happens behind the scenes. If I go to a show, like, you know, a concert, I like seeing the guys up, you know, climbing up the ladders and moving the lights and moving the equipment and seeing if I can see somebody backstage doing stuff. So it's that curiosity that has just been pervasive through my whole life. But yeah, none of it seemed out of the ordinary, even though I kind of knew it was. And I never questioned the legality of it. So, you know, making phone calls for free is illegal. But when you're 9 years old or 10 years old, you're not really thinking about that. You know, your brain just isn't developed enough to really think that. As I got to my teenage years, I think all of that had been so normalized to me that, you know, even as a teenager, you're not fully developed. So I just wasn't thinking about the consequences and thinking about what could go wrong. But at the same time, too, as using the computers is when I got, you know, into electronics. So being a hardware hacker, I knew early on, you know, hacking wasn't something you could have as a career. It just was not accepted. But I knew that I loved building electronic products. So even when I was that young, you know, 10 years old, 11 years old, I knew I was going to be an engineer. I was going to design electronics. I was going to do something where I could create something in my head, make a physical thing to do something. So a lot of my high school years were building projects out of magazines, sometimes modifying those, but it was always the projects of like how to make your own stun gun, you know, how to make an annoying sound generator that you could use in class, you know, a high pitched sound so the teacher won't know where it's coming from. So it was always this kind of mischievous side. And then later that ended up being, you know, how to make red boxes to simulate the sound of the coins going into a payphone to get free phone calls on there. And then how to clone cell phones so I could basically get a cellular phone, a mobile phone at the time, usually it was like a bag phone, modify the circuitry in there to essentially have the same account information of a legitimate account. So all of the phone calls from that cell phone got billed to somebody else. Like that was just for me a fun way to like go to my friends and be like, hey, look, we can make phone calls from school. And then it got a little more, maybe not malicious, but like I would start selling those things. So I was selling cloned cell phones. I was selling red boxes. I was selling free phone calls to people that I knew, store owners and things that were from other countries. So I would set them up on a payphone and they could call their home country and talk to their family and talk to their friends for free in exchange for, you know, getting trinkets from their shops and stuff like that. So it was really an entrepreneurial spirit, but it just none of it ever seemed wrong. And I think that's if somebody is listening to this, trying to think about how can I prevent hackers in my systems now, or how can I prevent these things? I think a lot of it is not personal. You know, nowadays for malicious people, it's how can we make money in the easiest way? But I think a lot of it is just normalized like it was for me, where because it's more faceless, it just doesn't seem real. And that didn't hit me really until I got arrested as a teenager. But even then, and even to this day, I still gravitate more towards like, well, you know, it shouldn't really be illegal to do that.
What did they get you for when you were arrested? Can you share that?
So at the time in 1992, I was involved in a hacker group called Renegade Legion, which was sort of an online, you know, BBS text files type of group. We were based all over the country, mostly Michigan and Boston, but there were guys, kids in a couple other places. Yeah, this is also a reminder too. You know, it's like at the time, the hacker community, hacker world, whatever you want to call it, really were mostly teenage kids exploring and kind of just messing around with things. At that time with Renegade Legion, you know, we were writing text files on how to do credit card fraud and how to use the credit bureau system. We were on a lot, and other hackers were at the time too, on things called AT&T Alliance teleconferences, which basically were giant conference systems used for corporations where, you know, you could have conference calls with people all around the world, or at least all around the country. I'm pretty sure, I didn't know this then, but I'm pretty sure the cost was like $5 a minute per person on that call. So you can imagine if you have, you know, 10 kids on there from 2 p.m. when school got out until 11 p.m. or even later, all night long, you know, that's going to be a big bill for somebody. Those were billed directly from the phone number that started it. So one of the things I would do is ride my bike downtown into downtown Boston, go into an alleyway, pop off the cover of the phone junction box that basically all the phone lines go in physically to one apartment building, clip on with my lineman's handset, start the call, start the teleconference, and then it would get billed to that number. And then I would transfer control over to a friend of mine. And then I'd hang up, bike home, and then we'd all get calls. So we were doing stuff like that. And that's kind of how we met, is through these teleconferences and through some bulletin board systems. Some prominent hackers were running these boards and we kind of were all seeing each other. So yeah, so Renegade Legion, for some reason in 92, somebody had the idea of like, hey, we should all get together and meet in person. And this was very early, right? That you didn't have hacker conferences every week going on. You didn't have maker spaces and things like that. This was just an organic kind of like, I don't even know if he meant it for real, but he's like, let's all get together. So it turns out that, you know, everybody's parents talked and arranged that we would all fly to Michigan to hang out. And, you know, my parents talked to the mother of this guy. His name was Dr. Death and, you know, made sure that they were legit, that I had a place to stay. And you know, they kind of felt each other out. And yeah, so for my winter break, sophomore year of high school, I flew to Michigan by myself and hung out with all these other hackers. And it started off pretty benign, you know, like we'd all been doing stuff online, but you know, we hung out, we played pool, we played video games, and then we're like, hey, let's go break into the AT&T telephone building in the trucks so we can like, you know, get hardware and get information and documentation that we couldn't get access to because we all loved the phone system. The phone system was sort of like, you know, the precursor to the internet. If you think about exploring the phone system, that was, you know, a massive network controlled by massive corporations. But to get physical hardware that you could manipulate the system with and documentation that nobody else had was kind of a like street cred, because you could then type up that documentation and post it for other people. And now it's like, ooh, you know, Kingpin got this info somehow. How'd he do that? It just seemed normal. You know, we were doing some shoplifting at computer stores before then on the same trip and stuff. And I think back now, you know, my son is 13, my oldest. And on one hand, it's like, why would my parents, you know, send me to Michigan on my own? But at this other side, it's like, you know, you're old enough to be independent, but not quite. But it's like, let's give him a chance and see what happens. So if my son was like, hey, I want to go meet a friend that I met on Minecraft and, you know, hang out for the weekend, like I would probably let him. But I also know that he's playing Minecraft. He's not upstairs in his room hacking on systems, because we're also, you know, we talk about a lot of that stuff too, and it's more of an open dialogue. We just made stupid teenage decisions and thought it'd be fun to break into the phone company. So we, you know, got some bolt cutters at the hardware store and some gloves, and we had our scanner radio set to the police frequencies of the area, and basically just went cut through the fence. We had, what were they called? Oh yeah, automatic center punches, you know, to mark holes in surfaces for when you're building things. And we smashed the windows of the trucks and got all the equipment that we could and had a great time and ran off. And then the great time didn't last long, because one of the neighbors actually had called the police thinking that, you know, there were a bunch of kids drinking in the park, kind of causing just mischief in the park. And then lo and behold, it was not kids drinking in the park. It was, you know, kids breaking into the phone company next door. Yeah, we got arrested and there was six of us. I was the only juvenile. So the other guys got a much harsher penalties. To me, that was the turning point where I had to fly home, and then I had to get a lawyer and fly back and still go through the preliminary hearings. But they ended up dropping charges pretty much solely because I was a juvenile, and it would have taken all this extra paperwork to redo the whole thing into that system. And they talked to my local police and made sure, you know, that I didn't have any other outstanding issues, you know, because I hadn't been caught for anything else at that point. So I just got lucky, totally lucky. And there's a lot of parameters that went into that. Socioeconomic issues and where I went to school and just a lot of things that I just got lucky and very privileged that ended up happening. And I fully acknowledge that if I came from a different background or if I looked a different way, it could have been totally different. So that was a real eye-opener to me in a lot of ways. And pretty much at that point kind of shifted my mindset of like, all right, I still love hacking. I love exploring, but I have to smarten up a little bit. I don't want to end up in jail. Some of the other guys did go to jail. I don't want to end up like that. That's where the turning point came, where I came back to Boston and two important things happened. One of them is my parents were like, well, you got to do a sport or get a job, because they knew I had to use my energy in some way. But they didn't want to prevent me from using computers solely because they knew that was my passion, right? So it's like, if we could just redirect him in a way that he can use his passion in the right way, then that's fine. So I ended up doing a sport and I started running track and cross country, not because I was good at it. I was still overweight. I was pudgy, but I had a bunch of friends that were running track and they're like, let's just run, you know, run track. It's fun. And it was, you know, it started out very simply as just a fun way to get my energy out. And I would still, you know, I'd go to track practice and I'd go home and mess on the computer, but it gave me a balance a little bit. And it gave me friends that were not in that world, which was very important. And running ended up being a lifelong kind of pursuit and practice. And I met my future wife on a post-collegiate track team. And I ended up running Division I track and field and cross country at Boston University. And it just became something that I realized I can still do my hacking, but having this other stuff just helped. I think even from like a mental health perspective of giving me an outlet and like that sort of angst of like whatever I was feeling that brought me to the punk rock world, it gave me something. So that was important. And then the other thing was the Boston hacker community at the time was very small. A lot of us had known each other. Some of these guys I'd known since I was 13 years old through bulletin board systems. And we'd started to meet up in person, a lot of us. There was a group called The Loft that had started in the early 90s that basically was like a bunch of the older hackers. I call them older, but they were probably 20 years old, you know, and I was 16. But they seemed so old and responsible. And so they started this little clubhouse to store some equipment. That was right around the time when I had gotten arrested. So after that, I still don't know why they invited me in, but they were like, okay, now he's gotten the dumb stuff out of his system, right? He's gotten in trouble. He's shifted direction. Let's let him join The Loft. So they invited me to join this group. And there were seven of us. It ended up being a huge life changer. I mean, the most important years of my life. And those were very formative years, right? 16 years old, just getting arrested, and then having these mentors that were also doing hacking. They worked IT jobs and network jobs and early computer security jobs. But it was a place that I could go and stay out of trouble and still hack on stuff and learn and hang out with people that were into that stuff also. And just seeing how they could share information and teach other people about things. You know, we would go to very early conferences. PumpCon was one of them in Philly, and TriCon in the tri-state area in New York, New Jersey. Very small groups, but just seeing how they behaved, right, and how they carried themselves was hugely influential for me. And that's really where the shift went from kind of malicious to more of a hacker trying to inspire people and help people and make things better. Though the transition wasn't entirely seamless. You know, I was still causing a little bit of trouble, but it took a little bit to get there. But yeah, that redirected the entire path of my life. And it could have ended up very differently, right? If I hadn't gotten arrested in Michigan, I would have for sure gotten arrested for something else, because it was just what I was doing was just getting more and more brazen I just wasn't thinking about the consequences until, you know, they slapped me in the face, basically.
Yeah, you were on that path, basically. Yeah,
exactly.
I saw some footage on, I think it was YouTube, of Loft when you all were asked to go before. Was it the U.S. Senate that you were asked to go before? Okay.
Yeah, it was the Senate, the Governmental Affairs Committee, okay, which is now the Governmental Affairs and Homeland Security Committee, I think.
Okay. And what did they invite you there for? They all seemed kind of confused in their line of questioning. They're kind of like, what do you guys do? I think Lieberman asked if he made me laugh with a question that he asked. He's like, I think anybody can get in. I don't know what he's talking about, but.
Yeah, so Senator Lieberman was like, he called us modern day Paul Revere's, which was like, wow. But yeah, so basically, so that was 1998. So The Loft kind of really got its formation in the early 90s. I would say 92 is when I got involved. And really for those early years, it was literally a clubhouse. We'd have hackers come, you know, friends of ours come crash on the floor, and we'd have just gatherings. And like there was an MIT flea market that was really a gathering point for a lot of the hackers and kind of electronics hobbyists in the area, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And a lot of times, you know, we'd go to the flea market together and then invite people back to The Loft and hang out. So it really was just a very organic community space before there were a lot of these organic community spaces. And it just felt really cool. It was the first time that I actually was learning to share not just information, but share my resources and share my equipment and learn from other people. So it was just a good social kind of time as well. We had a very early bulletin board system. We had a very early website. I don't exactly know how it started, but we started getting media attention with some local, you know, local media of like, ooh, you know, Boston area hackers doing something. And then it kind of progressed up the chain of like regional news and then larger news. And we really just were trying to spread the good side of what hackers can do and say, look, we could be malicious, but, you know, now we're not. Now we are finding vulnerabilities in things and helping people be aware of those and kind of releasing text files and going to conferences. And it was still at the time at The Loft where we weren't going full on trying to make it a paying thing that we could survive on. And my parents were still paying my rent. I think it was $50 a month for my portion of the rent. But yeah, just little by little, I guess organically, we started getting this media coverage. By the time 1998 rolled around, when we got invited to the Senate, a lot had changed. We had moved from our first loft space, is what it was, an artist loft space in kind of a sketchy area in the south end of Boston, which now is, you know, much fancier. But as a teenage kid, trying to get there was always an adventure. You know, like I was always worried that I was going to get jumped, but it was always a scary thing. And then Space Rogue, one of the other guys, would generally drive me home. And we had, you know, just to give you an idea, like we had our local crack fiend, his spot to smoke crack was outside of our door. And he was actually, for hacker historical buffs out there, our first Loft sticker that we brought to some of the early hacker conferences had a picture of him on there. And then, you know, watching Count Zero, one of the founders of the Loft, one day just got so sick of it, you know, he went and found out where this guy was hiding all of his drug paraphernalia and smashed it all. And I thought that was so badass of just like, you know, we don't want that around here. And he was sort of taking control of it. So I thought that was kind of cool. But yeah, so we moved from the South End to more of a light industrial office building in Watertown, Massachusetts, a little bit outside of the city. And we had a couple personnel changes. And that's when we decided to try to make the Loft more of a full-time thing. Like at that point, I was in college, almost done with college. Everybody wanted to kind of quit their jobs and see, could we do the Loft full-time? So the media attention just kept happening. We started finding, you know, vulnerabilities in Windows. We were the, you know, one of the first groups, at least, to publicize vulnerabilities that we found and force Microsoft to fix the problems. So when you hear about the discussion of full disclosure or responsible disclosure or whatever you want to call it, we were doing that, enforcing Microsoft to kind of acknowledge that they had problems. And that's now trickled into a whole industry on its own of finding vulnerabilities and disclosing those. But we were doing it not necessarily for the cred. Mostly it was like the guys that at the Loft that were working network security jobs in corporations like wanted to use that information to fix themselves. And they're like, well, if we're going to do that, let's just publicize it all. So just a little more, it was a little more structured and a little less anarchy hacker, I guess you would say, by that time. But anyway, we ultimately got invited to testify in front of the Senate to talk about the state of computer security and what hackers could do, which is a very vague thing. We basically went in and they wanted us to explain, like, look, we're seven people, kids, young adults, in a warehouse hacking on stuff, and look what we can do as just seven of us unorganized. Like, what could a state-sponsored actor do? What could an organized crime group do if they're focused? A lot of what we said back then is still completely true to this day, and really not a lot changed from our testimony, except it kind of legitimized being a hacker as a career. Because now that it was publicized, like, oh, being a hacker is cool. You can get paid money to research and find problems in other people's products. So like, and a couple of years later is when we saw a lot of computer security consulting companies starting to pop up. And a lot of those were started by hackers from our crew or hackers from other groups around the country, because now we could kind of come out of the woodwork a little bit and be like, yeah, we're hackers, you know, pay us. We didn't have to just do it, you know, as a side thing. And yeah, one of the main questions that came out of the Senate testimony was Senator Thompson had said, you know, I've heard you could take down the internet in 30 minutes. And that was something that Mudge, one of our guys, had written in the written testimony that we provided. And he had some ideas of some vulnerabilities in BGP routing, which is funny because when Facebook went down recently, that apparently was related to that, I think. But I'm a hardware guy, so don't quote me on that. But yeah, so he had some ideas about, yeah, you could take down the internet because you hit these core routing points and everything's going to fall apart. So that ended up being the main takeaway that, like, the press, you know, because they wanted that one soundbite. So it was like, hackers can take down the internet in 30 minutes. And it was all over the world, this news. Just, I didn't realize how huge that was of having hackers testifying in front of the government. And, you know, because up to that point, government to me was evil. And they were the man, right? They were the feds, and like they were out there to take you down, not to support you. But that was the first time where hackers were really invited to give testimony, not from a defensive, like sort of criminal side, but a state nation security thing of like what could happen. And I just graduated college. I was 22 or something, and still not, I didn't see the bigger picture like of how important it was. It was one of my first public speaking experiences and eye-opening to see and like really fun. But yeah, it did kind of kickstart things. And that also was the catalyst that changed the direction again of the Loft later on.
The evolution of each kind of stage for you is so interesting to hear about how, you know, each catalyst, I guess, and how it changed things. That's awesome.
Yeah. And a lot of times you don't even know that that's that turning point, right? It just is. And it wasn't until a couple of years later. And even looking back on it now, like people still talk about like, oh man, that testimony, that's what made me want to go into computer security. And that's what made me do this. And it's like, wow, like I just, you know, I was just a kid going, maybe the other guys knew what was going on, but I had no idea. I had to borrow my dad's suit, you know, to wear a suit. Cause like I didn't have one. I still don't have one. That was a rare occurrence.
This has been so fun listening to your, you know, how everything progressed for you. And I guess I'd love to know kind of, you know, you said that you always wanted to be an engineer, kind of like, you know, how did your career progress from there? And what have you been up to since? I know it's another big question, but.
Sure. So after The Loft, we ended up starting in the year 2000, a company called At Stake, which was one of the first computer security consulting companies. We would say boutique companies, because at that time you had a lot of these larger consulting companies, huge consulting companies, you know, saying they could do security. But we formed this group, the seven of us, along with some venture capitalists and some other hackers that had more consulting experience, and basically formed this consulting company where we would go and help companies, you know, understand their security risks and look at their hardware designs and look at their network designs and all of this stuff. And that was a real change too, because when that happened, the press was like, you know, hackers sell out. And there had been examples, you know, in 1980, I think it was 1983 or 84, the Legion of Doom hacker group had started ComSec, which was a computer security consulting company, but that was way too early, and they sort of fizzled out. But this was a big deal, right? Because hackers were already becoming more known because of the Senate testimony. You know, hackers sell out. And we did. To me, that was another life lesson. Like, getting arrested was one. The transition from Loft to At Stake, I know some of the other guys are like, oh, you know, they're older and like they have a different perspective. But because I was still young and it was such a, again, a formative time, like that really shook me, because it didn't turn out the way that my, maybe not naive, but very, you know, kind of positive outlook on things, what was going on. It basically became a company, right? And companies need to make money, and VCs want to make their money back. And I didn't enjoy being a consultant. I didn't like people telling me what to do. So in 2002, oh, also, like, when we started, Space Drogue got fired. So one of our core guys in The Loft, the executives at the company were like, well, he should be in marketing because he does a lot of the hacker outreach. And he was running this website called Hacker News Network that everybody would go to every day to see different hacker news. So they put him into marketing, and we just kind of let that happen. And then they fired him like a couple weeks later. And again, like, us as a group, as The Loft, did not stand up and kind of bind together and protect our friends and look out for our friends. And it really splintered everybody apart. What started as this very organic, you know, flat kind of hierarchy became a company. It just wasn't for me. So I ended up leaving in late 2002 to start my own company. But before then, so in the earlier days of The Loft, from 97 to 2000, before we started At Stake, when I graduated college, I was working at a product development company doing engineering. And even before then, you know, I was doing some consulting work, and I would go actually to this company and help them out after school with doing some IT work. And then it was engineering work. So I was designing mostly medical devices, portable medical devices, and some biomed, some industrial things. And I was basically the main engineer. And then my manager was kind of the senior engineer. So it was, and he was my mentor there. So we were building products and working with mechanical engineers and industrial designers and understanding. That's where I got to learn the whole production life cycle of designing products and prototyping and mass production and everything. So it was really all of these skills that ended up being handy, because when I started my own company, I was so sick of security. I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. It's becoming too corporate, right? Like, all these consulting companies, it's like, it didn't feel good to be involved in security, because I still liked it from this pure exploratory, passionate, messing around with things perspective. And sort of punk DIY aesthetic went away, and it just didn't feel right. So I basically started doing consulting again around electronics, though. So it wasn't somebody really telling me what to do. It was somebody saying, hey, I want this thing that can do this. And it's like, all right, let me design it and I'll get back to you when it's done. And that was really satisfying for a while. But then, you know, I just got sucked back into doing security probably in 2004, 2005. And basically since then, I've been focused on teaching hardware hacking to organizations, to people that need to understand how to design secure electronic products. But more often, it's people who want to understand how hackers are attacking their products, the hacker mindset of how to approach attacking products, and really teaching all of the stuff that I grew up doing. But now I've magically somehow been able to make a career out of teaching people what I love to do and feel good about it. It doesn't feel like a job. It feels like what I was meant to do is share this information, kind of like what I learned at The Loft, but now do it on a larger scale. And I'll do public conferences. Usually I'll do Black Hat in the US every year. Sometimes I'll do some of their other regional Black Hat conferences, and I try to do some community, smaller community conferences. And then I do a lot of private trainings as well. So on site, you know, I'll go around the world, wherever they need me to go. I'll bring all my gear with me, set up a hardware hacking, basically a hardware hacking lab for everybody, and teach them. It's been great because now with hardware hacking too, I use my engineering skills. I use my hacking skills. I get to keep my passion. I do what I want to do. Nobody's telling me what to do. I can choose what projects interest me. If I find something that's worth sharing with the world, I'll make a video about it, or I'll give a presentation about it, or I'll just release the information and let other people do what they will with it. I'm not directly involved in, you know, day-to-day kind of computer security. There's so much now. It's like a full-time job just to keep track of everything. But seeing how that landscape has changed into going from malicious kids or curious kids to now, you know, intentionally organized groups and state-sponsored attacks and everything that we talked about in our testimony happening and our reliance of technology, it's a really interesting time to be involved in this.
You've been like ahead of the curve every step of the way, basically. But I'm really happy to hear that you're able to teach and to manage your schedule and you know, do what you want to do. I think that that's really important. And I really enjoy your like developmental insights in each stage that you've shared with us so far. I think that's really fascinating. I was a psych major, so that's probably why. But
I've always been curious about what drives hackers versus, you know, other people, right? Like, why did I end up this way, but most of my other peers didn't? Like, I think that's a fascinating topic. And yeah, I mean, there's just so many lucky points along the way that I'm grateful for, and people along the way that I'm grateful for. And the fact that there's enough interest in hacking and in hardware hacking that I can do what I love is rare, right? And it's like, it's very special. And that's why every time I teach a class, or every time I give a talk, or anytime I do anything, it's this true love of what I'm doing. I don't love the big business side of it, you know, going to a conference and seeing, you know, billions of dollar valued companies pushing security products that probably don't do anything, or pushing something to scare other people into buying their product. But the pure hacking, exploring side of causing systems and causing electronics to do things that they weren't intended to do is just as powerful to me now. And having these skills of like being able to inject faults into microcontrollers to cause them to misbehave, like that is just as powerful to me now and just as exciting, as you can probably tell from me talking about it, as it was when I was 8 years old, 9 years old, 10 years old, building my first circuit board, making my first free phone call, cloning my first cell phone, placing my first stolen credit card order. Like, it's this passion that just keeps on giving as long as you can, you know, handle the ups and downs and the trials and the errors and the challenges with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Very cool. And I guess, Joe, if anyone listening wants to get in touch with you for your services, is there a, I mentioned your Twitter, but I mean, is there a better way for someone to get in touch with you? I wasn't sure.
Twitter is very much usually a one-way outlet for me to just spew information. It, because, you know, otherwise you're communicating with the entire world, and I'm still a relatively private, paranoid person. So I'll usually post on Twitter if you're interested in following what I'm doing on a relatively regular schedule. I'll post pictures and stuff there. But to contact me, you can go to my website, which is grandideastudio.com, and there's a contact page. And on the contact page, you can, you know, fill out the form, send that to me, and that will go directly to me. And I do try to respond to everybody at least once, unless the requests are like completely ridiculous of like, you know, teach me everything about hacking, or can you hack my wife's whatever, which yes, you know, people still ask for things like that. But yeah, you know, that's the best way to get in touch with me. Keep an eye out. There's a bunch of new work I'm working on, and a video and a story should be coming out in the next couple of weeks about some cryptocurrency wallet hacking that I did recently that I'm super proud of. And yeah, you know, it's like, just follow me. And if you have questions, feel free to reach out.
Thank you so much for taking the time to come on to the show and share with us your story. I've really enjoyed speaking with you, and I'm sure that our audience has really enjoyed listening to you. So thank you so much, Joe. I really appreciate it.
No, thanks again for having me. And thanks to everybody out there for listening.
I'm Hillary McClure, Multimedia Director at Cybercrime Magazine. Joining us today was Joe Grand, a hardware hacker, also known as Kingpin. To know more about Joe, you can follow him on Twitter at Joe Grand. And you can listen to more podcast episodes like this, as well as our internet radio station, Cybercrime Radio, WCYB, by visiting cybercrime.radio.